Hey everyone, and welcome to The Rational Republican, a podcast where we look at complex issues facing us here in Oregon and around the nation. We'll try to address issues from a nonpartisan perspective and view our disagreements through a lens of respect rather than tribalism or divisiveness. I'm James Ball. This is Nick Perlasky.
Hey listeners, how we doing?
Today's podcast is brought to you by ProLift Garage Doors. ProLift is your one-stop shop for residential and small commercial garage doors, from openers, springs, and rollers to full reinstalls. They offer same-day service and all garage door repairs with no extra charge for evenings or weekends. Serving the greater Portland metro area, call today and set up your free estimate at 503-558-6349 or at proliftdoors.com/portland. Again, that's 503-558-6349. 6349 or proliftdoors.com/portland. On this episode of the podcast, we welcome back Mr. Frank Patka, who has been on the podcast before, but like way back at the beginning. So it has been a minute since you've been on here. He is the executive director of Changing Patterns, a nonprofit that helps people getting out of the judicial system reintegrate into society. He's also the author of the book, The Returning Citizen's Survival Guide, which we have right here in front of us. So, Frank, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Nick, James, definitely enjoyed my time last time, and now let's see if we can. I think last time I spit some facts that were incorrect, so this time we'll try to dial it in better.
Oh no, that's the whole reason we have a podcast, is so we can just say whatever. We could say the sky is green, and there's nobody here to name.
Yeah, there's nobody. Yeah,
nobody's watching this.
Just kidding, listeners. Please,
Ryan.
So, how's the trip? You're living in Texas these days, right?
During the wintertime. When it's snowing in Bend, I spend my time in Texas, actually. My girlfriend lives down there and slowly moving to Austin, Texas. It's wonderful. Yeah. Shout out to the girlfriend, Cheryl. I absolutely love it down there right now.
Nice. So, just like six months kind of thing?
I wish it was that good. 3 months down there, and then I got to come back up here. We still have a landscape company that I work with, and then the nonprofit, too, is starting to take off, which I'm excited to share about.
This is very exciting. I went to school in Austin, and after we finish up this episode, I'm going to talk to you about all the wonderful bars and all the fun stuff on 6th Street and everything. Listeners, if you haven't been, go visit Austin. It's a wonderful city.
UT?
UT.
All right. Longhorn.
So, what have you been doing with Changing Patterns? You mentioned that you got some updates for us.
Yeah. So, COVID, February 2020, we launched our mentor program, and then where there's lots of person-to-person mentoring, one-on-one mentoring, and then March 2020, the world shut down.
Yeah.
And so we didn't really get a chance to see how this mentor program was going to work. And that actually led to me writing the book. I had all this stuff in my mind. I had everything going on, focused on this mentoring piece, and then they stopped it. So I wrote this book, and then it sat on the shelf for a couple of years. And then our operations director, one of the best friends I've ever had, Ryan McCrone, stepped in the picture and helped me edit and revise the book a little bit. And we got it published. And that led to Ryan and I stepping in back into this role of relaunching Changing Patterns. We kept it alive, but just it wasn't operational.
Yeah. Hard to do much anything during that period of time. So,
So this last year, Ryan and I spent the whole time rebuilding capacity. We had 3 founding board members, had our first live in-person board meeting in February of 2023. Now we have 9 board members, and we have been developing a program, we submitted for a couple grants. We didn't get them, but in the process, we did get the opportunity to build what is called the Peer Support Reentry Program, which is our new version of the mentor program.
Okay. So how do you pick people for your mentor program?
Yeah, right now it's a referral based only. So it's individuals who are coming out immediately out of prison. We were working with both community corrections, so parole and probation, and then also Bethlehem Inn, which is a high barrier shelter in Central Oregon, Deschutes County. that is also one of the transition facilities for people getting out of prison. And so someone lands there and then they send a referral to us and we start the process of onboarding and working with them. Currently, we have three clients that we just launched in February or January, sorry, just launched in January. And we have three clients that are coming on, and we have a gentleman named Dave Cassano who just went through a peer support specialist training and is now actively mentoring. And this process is actually, we're partnered with Central Oregon Community College, where individuals who graduate the program will earn a scholarship to become a peer support specialist, which is a traditional health worker. So we're building a pathway for people getting out of prison and to enter the healthcare system as an employee.
Very cool.
What are still some of the obstacles that you come up against? Is it, you know, obviously James and I complain about government and red tape and bureaucracy and everything on that. We're wonderful at that on this show. Is it a lot of that? Is it financial obstacles that you come up against? Is it just kind of sociological? Just people still are just like, well, I appreciate the work that you're doing, but I don't know if I'm there yet. What are kind of some of the hurdles that you see?
Yeah. So the tangible, easy to picture obstacles are securing housing, securing employment, although that's gotten a lot easier with our labor market and people are hiring left and right, connecting with the transportation opportunities. Thankfully, people getting out of prison are traditionally have access to healthcare, so they'll set up on OHP, and then also they have their food stamp benefits set up. And then and then the other pieces are setting up a bank account, making sure they get all their documentation, and then building a new support system. So those are like the tangible ones, but really the big barriers are what happens when you get mad? What happens during these emotional moments and you want to react with this old behavior? Setting boundaries, especially with old friends, old acquaintances, saying no to certain situations, handling rejection. That's a big one, right? Whether it comes to work, rebuilding relationships, handling rejection. We've seen people really struggle when like they have this whole mindset on I'm going to attain this, I'm doing well, and then they don't get the result they want. Well, in life, that's normal. But yeah. when we're going through a really volatile time like reentry, this just compounds on everything else. And you know, as we saw with COVID, not everyone has the ability to react to adversity in a healthy way, and our clients have a tendency to react in a more unhealthy way. I know, speaking for myself, you know, I was in prison. I'd spent quite a long time. Acting in a healthy way. So I understand that. And so a big part is those not so tangible obstacles that get in the way. And one of our biggest things we try to teach is play the tapes. Okay. So like role playing is a big part. Early on, we know you're going to face these things. We know you're going to have to experience rejection, have to set boundaries, run into someone and then go, hey, come on, let's go out to the bar. And you're like, no, I can't do that. It's going to ruin my supervision. And so what we do is we go, hey, let's do this technique where you play the tapes. In that moment, if you can just play the tapes through, like if I get out of the car and fight this guy for cutting me off or flipping me off, what is the end result? Is the end result what I want? No. So, but doing that in the moment, if you haven't practiced, is dang near impossible. And so what we like to do is in the background, let's role play this. Let's give you a couple opportunities to practice it. So when it happens in life, you have a better chance to go, wait, play these tapes and hopefully go, oh, that's not the outcome I want, and make a different decision.
Well, it's good that some of the more systemic issues are getting easier for you guys, like the employment and housing and that kind of thing. And I can definitely see how mentorship would really be helpful. Is there any sort of government program that does that, or other nonprofits, or is it just kind of a newer thing to mentor people, or just typically do people just like get tossed out of prison and the parole officer is really the only thing that they've got to kind of mentor them back into society?
So the parole officer is interesting because one of the stigmas we're trying to change is instead of looking at your parole officer as an authority figure, look at them as a resource. Hmm. Your parole officer's job is to assist you in navigating these barriers and obstacles, connecting with housing, connecting with employment. That's their role. Their job is to create a safe community by giving the people that are under their supervision all the resources they need to participate in community as a productive member. The mentor piece has been a growing piece for reducing recidivism, for assisting individuals exiting the correctional system. And now in Oregon, we're really starting to come to start using a system called peer support specialist. I can't remember if it started in Georgia or Pennsylvania. Colorado was the first. Oh yeah, that's right, Colorado.
All three good states.
Yeah. So, but this peer support specialist concept is a person with lived experience that walks through this time of this volatile time, this really sensitive time with you. And so, right now, there's four categories in peer support specialist to be certified in, and it's substance abuse, behavioral health, adult, and then adult family, and then youth. And so these categories, we basically you get certified in, and it's a lot of the training is the same across the board, but then with specific to the category. And so our mentors are trained in the behavioral health category, and use this stuff. Actually, Ryan would be great talking about this stuff, but this certification takes mentoring and turns it into a certified position, a healthcare position, and an opportunity to get paid. So you can tap into Medicaid, and you can bill insurance based on these new positions. So it's turned mentoring into a healthcare position rather than this, obscure position.
Yeah.
Bouncing around in the outskirts.
So if you've got the, you know, obviously your primary focus is working with individuals who are coming out of the system, who are trying to get back into normal life, however would be the best way to phrase that, living on their own, having a job, having friends that are, you know, responsible. You mentioned parole officers and how you would like the individuals that you work with to view them. Do you work at all with anybody in the corrections institutions? Do you work with anybody who is serving as a parole officer? Do you work with law enforcement in any way to try to say, we want to get these folks to be able to meet you halfway. We don't want them to feel like they're coming out of adult timeout. We do want them to be able to feel like they're coming back and being members of society who are able to contribute and improve on their own lives and continue to live and enjoy freedom. Can you guys, you know, meet us halfway a little bit and not be, you know, systematically oppressive, not be, you know, just the coming down like the only serving to be disciplined, but can you guys work to use yourselves more as resources and be able to not just be hindrances or like the bad guys in the situation, or at least the bad guys that the, you know, individuals that you're working with have kind of come to view you as, you know, putting them away for however many years it was.
Have you worked with the Department of Corrections before? No.
I have not.
No. So the system itself, just like any, like the prison industrial complex, it has its own challenges. There's a lot of stigma with it. However, yes, there's one thing. So you mentioned parole and probation. So even though they are part of the corrections umbrella, they are a step to the side or a step, how would you say it, in the pathway of the judicial system. There's these things called intercepts. I don't want to get too far into that. But So to answer your question, we have a really good relationship with Deschutes County Corrections, Community Corrections. So the parole and probation officers in Deschutes County, work with us. We've built a good relationship with them. They actually are referring us clients for a program we call the Moving Forward Project, where we actually go pick up individuals who don't have a ride home from prison and bring them back, provide safe transport. In that process, we take them out to breakfast, give them a welcome home breakfast. We have a starter pack that's a backpack. It's got some clothes, some hygiene, a book, that book too, a journal, a planner. And we give them a ride home. And during that time, we talk to them about, one, your PO is a resource. Mm-hmm. Two, the community believes in your successful reentry. And evidence of that is all this project itself. So we had a fundraiser this last December, raised $13,000, I think.
Nice.
Raised enough money to pay for this project throughout the whole year. So this backpack, these resources, this breakfast, this ride home, this is all paid for by the community of Central Oregon as in good faith to say, hey, look, we believe in your successful reentry. And then our third thing we say is no new crime. All right. If you can just let's reduce recidivism by not committing a new crime. And how this is all wrapped in is creating a sense of belonging. We believe that if someone feels that there's a sense of belonging in the community, they're less likely to step back towards committing a crime and consider asking help from their resources. And so our community corrections has been very supportive of that. On the flip side, with Department of Corrections, we're working on breaking into prison. They're definitely not just open doors, letting us come in and, interrupt the way they do things. But there are people in the system that are supportive of new ideas, new change, and we're getting closer to getting a chance to show that us returned citizens with lived experience who want to give back to our community, make amends by being of service, have good ideas on helping people reconnect with community, and hopefully in turn that will reduce crime, create safer communities, create a sense of belonging, which then on the flip side, now you've got an employee, you have a person for the workforce, right? You have families coming back together. So there's a big swing on this. It's not just, oh, we're reducing crime and people aren't committing crime. No, there's economic benefits. There's social benefits.
Yeah.
So, you're a taxpayer now. You get to contribute to all the wonderful services. I mean, I think my taxes are too high. Don't get me wrong. I wish I could pay less in taxes, but I'd rather be paying some because I'm earning money and I'm taking part in society. And, I'm here.
I would love nothing better than to write a 6-figure check to the government because it's, 30% of what I made that year.
You don't have to. You can write it to us instead. As a 501c3 nonprofit, we will gladly take your tax money instead. Yeah.
Good to know. Well, so one of the things we wanted to kind of touch on since you're here and you have kind of have an interesting perspective on things is Measure 110. Obviously, the people listening to this probably are very familiar. The decriminalization of drugs in Oregon, and then just this within a week ago, the legislature then removed some of those pulled out the decriminalization. I'm not exactly sure what went into that bill. Maybe Nick is smarter than I am.
Nope.
Like which parts were pulled out?
No, he is not.
All right. Nick and I both have new kids, and so some of our research has dropped off a little bit on stuff happening in the legislature right away. But I don't know. I don't think Measure 110 was a thing back when you were on the show last time.
No, it wasn't. So it came through before. And started to get – it was implemented in 21, voted on in 20.
Yeah.
It's been a very fascinating social experiment, right? So if we look at this as a social experiment, one, if it's an experiment, we've got these data points that we say this is happening and then now we want to look at the outcome and then decide if it worked. Mm-hmm. The first thing to get it off, right off the bat, there was a complete anomaly that happened at the beginning of the social experiment called the pandemic.
Right.
So that means all the results are skewed anyway. So we don't know if this social experiment would work in that aspect because of what happened with the pandemic, this health pandemic, but also an economic pandemic where there was this huge shift of financial what do you call it? Just money.
Nobody could work.
Moving from one, how displaced. So just get that out of the way. Whatever the results are, it's got to have an asterisk with that. The second part is, so I actually had the opportunity to talk with a gentleman today, Kyle Hedquist, who is works closely with CURE, which is an organization that works with people who are in prison, and then also spends a lot of time in legislature and talks with this stuff. He's also a formerly incarcerated returned citizen. One of the things I asked him, I said, you know, I'm going to go talk about this today. And he's been right. He's been on the floor. He's been talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
And he said the first thing was that Measure 110 was set to shift the mentality of addiction from criminal to treatment, right? So a big part of Measure 110 when it was brought in was to decriminalize addiction.
Right.
Not necessarily drugs, but the addiction piece. And it was supposed to – going to jail doesn't – help people fight their addiction. It may interrupt their addiction for a little while, but just sitting in a cell, no one thought, man, maybe I should stop doing drugs. Mm-hmm. It takes treatment. It takes this whole process. And so the idea of Measure 110 was to take away the ability to
just throw people in a cell.
Throw people in a cell and not have to think about them. And so with the understanding of that piece, it wasn't about the drugs. It was about the addiction. And then also, there is a whole, I mean, when it comes to change, change is a process. Mm-hmm. It's not a switch. And when you're creating this incredible disruption called decriminalizing drugs, the process of itself is going to be some ups and downs, right? Mm-hmm. So anytime there's disruption, if you look at it like a pendulum, there's going to be the swinging back and forth.
Right.
And right now, we're experiencing that swinging. But it's going to take some time to settle into where it's supposed to be. Part of the swinging is going, hey, we didn't foresee these things happening over here. So we need to adjust and we need to change. I'm not 100% sure whether I'm behind fully the 408, 4002. Yeah. There's some things in it that the wording in it sounds good. There was a thing about how the way they're supposed to have these off ramps for people set up by the end of December. Well, we've had 2 years to have these things implemented and it hasn't happened yet.
This is going to be like treatment facilities and social workers and that kind of thing to.
Right. Instead of throwing them in jail, right? So if you go out and you throw a bunch of homeless drug addicts in jail, now you just got a bunch of full beds and. Now what do you do? What happens when there's a crime going on? What happens? What do we do from there? So it's not solving anything. There's supposed to be this. There's supposed to be implementing this, and it'll be interesting to see what it looks like come December when this report comes out. But the key part is we want to make sure we're not recriminalizing addiction. We're focused on treatment. The other thing is it takes a process to go to build. To set up these treatment facilities.
Right.
Right. So like if this apartment wasn't built, someone didn't go, hey, we're going to build this apartment. Let's do it. And then tomorrow it's here. It doesn't just appear.
Right.
And you need to create the staffing. If you don't have the staffing or personnel, now you need to create this. You need to get people certified to have the staffing, not
the training. Yeah.
The training, the building, the process in itself. I mean, it's taken us a year to establish a pretty simple mentor program. So now we're talking a statewide execution of changing addiction as a crime to a treatment. And then throw in the fact that the human variable has a wide range of results, right? So like I might be in a different process of stage of change than Ryan's in a stage of change than Nick is.
Yeah.
But we all have to go through this one door to reach that point.
Well, that was one of my criticisms of Measure 110 from the beginning was everybody finds that path differently. Everybody who's going through, some people need therapy. Some people need mentorship. Some people need to hit rock bottom. And until they hit rock bottom, they will not change. And so what I think Measure 110 did was it took away that option. There is no longer an opportunity for somebody to, because I've talked to people who that was the thing. It was going to jail, was getting arrested. It was hitting that point and that they never thought they would, that finally convinced them that, oh, I need to change something.
But do you think it was jail that changed it, or was it the treatment that they went to after they went to jail? So like the amount of people that actually credit jail for getting sober or finding that that was the interruption.
I would say
it's the treatment piece that's going to take someone there.
Well, treatment isn't effective unless the person chooses that that's what they want to do. And it was jail, or it was getting arrested, or it was that, you know, that trauma that convinced them that, oh, I need to go seek help. So you're right. The jail isn't what cured it, but jail was the thing that made them realize that they needed to go seek treatment and needed to go get. So
I could also tell you that there's worse things in jail.
Yeah.
As rock bottoms. You don't need jail That's for rock fair. Bottom.
I mean, absolutely. Right. But wouldn't it, again, I think that jail is preferable to those other things.
Jail,
right?
Yes, jail is preferable. I also actually was talking, you know, Neil.
Yeah.
We were talking about this the other day, and one of his thoughts on it was, and shout out Neil Costello, greatest photographer in the history of photography.
Neil, come on the pod.
Yeah. He would be entertaining for sure. You get some quotes off that one. No, but one of the things he was saying is like, Measure 110 removed the ability for law enforcement to interrupt people's addiction. And this is where I do agree with on that piece is, you know, as someone who's had my bouts with addiction, and been around it for a long time, I know that if someone, say, if I'm in the throes of addiction and I get arrested and they give me a ticket, but leave me in the area where I can access the same stuff, that's not an interruption. And so what happened is it did take law enforcement's ability to interrupt. And if you give someone 3-4 days to clear up, that's where that moment of clarity might happen. And that's where I believe a part of the change should look at is how do you you're forcing someone to think, you're forcing someone to get to a place of considering something healthy. But that interruption, that moment, if I'm not given an opportunity to clear my mind, I may not. And I think that is one of the weaknesses of Measure 110 is it took away the ability for the community using law enforcement to interrupt the cycle and give the individual an opportunity to have a little moment of clarity. Because if they don't get interrupted, and if you take away my drugs but leave me on the sidewalk next to the guy who gave me the drugs, the other piece was like, you can take your ticket and turn it in to get an assessment, and then they'll waive the $100 fine or whatever. Though the problem is, after the assessment, where do they go? Oh, thanks, good test. Well, if I walk out of the door, I'm still on my free will. Well, I look around, oh, there's the homie with the drugs.
Yeah.
So I do believe that there needs to be some sort of interruption. And I hope that as they figure this out, I hope they don't quit the social experiment. I hope they keep moving towards how is this going to work. And we let the pendulum go back and forth and understand that this is probably like a 10-year experiment.
Yeah.
To really get some results that we go, okay, this is working or this isn't working. And but we need to be patient.
So what do you think the solution would end up being? You have the interruption, you get detoxed for a couple of days, maybe it's not prison, maybe it's somewhere else. Is there then like mandatory treatment? Do you kind of go on probation for a little bit where you have to talk to somebody every couple of days? Or what do you think that is the best way to get somebody through that addictive process?
Yeah. So it would be great if it was that easy. Just like, yeah, man, we just wave it.
Just go check a couple boxes and talk to some people and you're clean.
Yeah. Number one, there has to be some desire by the individual. They don't have to want it all the way, but they have to – life has to be so uncomfortable that there has to be some level of consideration of doing something different. I remember when in my last 6 months of in prison, I went through a intense treatment program. Mm-hmm. And I remember the counselor I was talking to her one time, and she said, "No one changes when they're comfortable, which is why we make your life uncomfortable here." She said, "You know, if it's storming out and you're sitting in your house in a comfortable chair next to a fire reading a book, you're not going to move. You're just going to chill. But if that roof gets ripped off and it starts pouring down the rain inside the house, you're not going to continue sitting there. You're going to move." And so if you look at that, there needs to be a level of uncomfort, which you mentioned, you know, that rock bottom, whatever that looks like. For me, my rock bottom was sitting in the hole in prison and in the bathroom 24 hours a day for the summer of 2011. And I was like, okay, while our friend Jeremy Cham sends me letters and pictures of him on Vespas in the in the islands in Bahamas.
Oh, man.
You know, I'm like, whoa, we used to live together and now he's there and I'm here. Something needs to change. Me. So that first piece is the individual does have to experience enough pain to go, this isn't, maybe let's consider something. The other thing is when their lives get interrupted. So jail, there's this opportunity with jail. Let's flip the script and look at jail as a treatment opportunity. You've got a captive audience.
Yeah, they're not going anywhere.
They're not going anywhere. I'm telling, let's pump propaganda over the speakers. Like you got David Goggins yelling at him, get up, you know? I mean, whatever, you know, maybe not that, but I mean, if you're in jail, you're sitting in your cell. Look, there's your rights are gone, your privileges are gone based on the fact that whatever you committed a crime. Look, we should not be just arresting people for being drug addicts. We shouldn't arrest people for that, but we should have this opportunity to give to interrupt their lives. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I was told today that the jail interruption isn't painting with a big brush. Like it's that's actually a small amount of people that change from that piece. But on the flip side, almost all of us started with jail.
Yeah.
And then wherever the course goes after that, is a different piece. So you've got, it's the human variable. I don't know what the solution is. But I know that the solution isn't leaving the addict in the same environment that they're still, using in.
Well, one of my concerns with way Multnomah County in particular has dealt with Measure 110 and the homelessness issue here in the metro area has been the idea of harm reduction. So rather than doing, and I'm just curious your thoughts on that, because it's like they're handing out tinfoil and plastic straws and, you know, kits to do drugs more safely and tents. And I feel like it's interesting you bring up comfort, because I feel like that is making people more comfortable while they slowly commit suicide on the streets. Is there is harm reduction a valid way to deal with people? Does it play a part in this?
It's another social experiment that we have had quite a few talks about. I don't think giving people drugs is going to help them get off drugs.
That's fair. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah. That part doesn't... I don't believe in that. I do think that there are people who have found ways out of addiction through the use of methadone. Say we're talking heroin addicts and stuff, right?
Yeah.
I know that like the needle exchange is to stop the passing of diseases. So that's an important part.
I think
Multnomah
County isn't even doing a needle exchange. They're just handing out needles.
Yeah. Well,
so then they use needles, end up in playgrounds and sidewalks.
And giving out tinfoil is ridiculous. I don't even know if that's true, but if it is, that's wildly insane, because like that's just enabling the use. My opinions on harm reduction is just that. It's like, I haven't seen enough of it to, believe in it. But there's a movement for it, and it's a social experiment, and I hope there's a way to figure that out. I just, again, so one of the reasons why that book sat on the shelf for a couple of years is during COVID, I had my own bout and started getting, I just had got stuck and ended up doing a little too much cocaine for a little too long. Mm-hmm. And had a moment where I didn't think, you know, I thought I was going to give everything away. As far as like my dreams, this idea of helping our community and all this stuff. And I got really, I learned what it was like to not want to do something and still keep doing it, which was a wild time for me. It was the first time that I really understood what addiction feels like. And it's scary. And it's scary. Mm-hmm. And you know what? The only way I could stop was to remove myself from the people who I was doing it with, or where it was coming from. It was the only way I could do it. And that's where it comes back to this whole piece of the harm reduction and the piece of not being able to interrupt people's lives when they're in their addiction. Because in recovery, it's people, places, and thing, and things that bring us back.
They bring you back.
Right? And so if the people that I'm around are using, and the places that I'm around are providing it, and the things that I'm using with are available, why am I going to stop?
Yeah. And that takes a lot of willpower to do that.
Or so, an interruption.
Or an interruption, right. Well, I was just going to say, not a lot of people have that willpower to say, I am giving up everything that I worked for. I need to remove myself. They need a little bit of assistance with that.
I'm going to leave here and get Taco Bell tonight. I don't have the willpower to not do that. I can't even imagine, you know, going through and something that's actually seriously addicting, like actual drugs. Mm. Yeah, that's I would have nowhere near the willpower if it wasn't for somebody coming and stopping and interrupting. And it is, I laud the state of Oregon for Measure 110 for trying to do what they purportedly tried to do. And I think it just failed miserably. I think this is one of those, you know, best laid plans of mice and men kind of thing. But
it's not over. You can't call it a failure if it hasn't been finished, right? Because we're talking about a social experiment for an entire state, right? You've ever tried to like create a cultural change in your company?
Right.
Like that might take a couple years in itself. So we're talking about a social like experiment through an entire state with something that is incredibly powerful that we haven't figured out how to solve for years, right? The best plan for addiction right now, still the most successful, is like 12-step meetings, AA and NA. That is the most successful rate. And even you look at those, we're talking batting averages here, right? Yeah. Like 200, 300 at best. So
no, I
wouldn't call it a failed experiment yet, especially that it's still going.
Well, I certainly agree with that. I don't necessarily, and again, I appreciate the goals with which the state and with which the voters who voted for Measure 110 came at the problem, because I think everybody agrees, if you're pro or anti Measure 110, everybody agrees with the goal of it would be great to have fewer addicts. It would be great to have no addicts. It would be great to have no fentanyl overdose, no, you know, any of these things that are blights on our society. And you know, obviously, we'll go back and forth on the efficacy of said, you know, Measure 110 to this point, but I do think that it is it's not something that's just going to end on its own. I don't think that it's just gonna, well, it's just, you know, hope that people just pick themselves up by their bootstraps and just say, you know what, I've been a meth addict for 10 years, but as of today, I'm done. And it's,
I don't think anyone's saying that either, though.
No, yeah. Well, I think there's probably a lot of free market conservatives who would just say, yeah, they'll figure it out on their own, or they won't. And it's their own problem. And it's like, well, it's not their own problem. It's a pretty big problem.
It's a societal problem. Yeah.
That's a good point, though.
The state of Oregon.
What you're saying there, like, oh, they'll figure it out on its own. One of our things we talk about with reentry is it takes community. The community is also responsible for its community members, mm-hmm. right? We can't just turn a blind eye and say we hope it'll work. We can't be ostriches and stick our heads in the sand and hope when we pop back up, the danger's gone. No, we're responsible. We're responsible for this community as community members. We are. whether we created the problem, if we want to live here, if we want to complain, then we also have a responsibility to be part of it. Right. And it's not just checking a little box on the ballot. It's going, hey, let's stop being individual houses. Let's stop being this like siloed community that the pandemic created. And let's get our hands dirty and start getting into it and go, hey, I don't believe Measure 110 is doing well. I want to be part of the change. What's the change? It's not just checking a box. It's getting in there and going, okay, let's learn about that. I mean, you both admitted that you haven't really been up on what's going on with Measure 110, right? So then how can we have an opinion on it?
Yeah.
Also, you brought up fentanyl too.
Hit me.
There is nothing that makes sense about fentanyl being in drugs. As a person who has sold and done drugs, I can tell you there is nothing about fentanyl that is productive for both ends of it. The drug dealers shouldn't be doing it because it's going to kill your client base. The client base shouldn't be wanting to do it because it's going to kill them. Methamphetamine deaths are up 20%. People don't die on meth. That's crazy. So where did this fentanyl come from? Why is it here? Who's making it? I'd like to play in the conspiracy world a little bit, but I can just tell you this. It's not the cartels in Mexico putting fentanyl in our drugs. It's not the crazy. And I mean, there's individuals who are doing it now who are bringing it into the system, but there's no reason why fentanyl should be in our drugs. There's something, it doesn't make sense.
Well,
from that aspect. And so I think there's something to really consider. Why did fentanyl start showing up when we started this social experiment a couple years ago? You know what I mean?
I'm curious about that because I thought it was because it was cheaper that they were able to cut it with other stuff and make, you know.
Could be.
That's what I thought it was.
Could
that
be.
They're selling fentanyl pills for $2 a piece downtown Portland.
Mm-hmm.
So you crush it up, you cut it with some cocaine and you sell it as cocaine that costs you a third of what it.
But where did it come from?
Well, fentanyl.
People started. Like, my thing is, why did it get into the system? You know what I mean? Why did it get
there in the first place?
Yeah, why did it get into the system? Yes. Oh, dude, I watched people smoke fentanyl. They love it now. But it got to a point. Why did it get into the system? It's just a
synthetic opioid. I mean, so when Rebecca had Noah, her epidural was fentanyl.
Okay.
You know, that's what they use it for. It's a medical.
Yeah.
We went through birthing classes and as they said, now like this is going to be one of the things that you get offered. And before you go all NPR, you should know that it is an actual thing that does have an actual purpose.
Yeah.
Just like anything, obviously it can be abused and I think is in the context that we're discussing is grossly, grossly abused.
Right.
There's not a lot of people, you know, outside Rialto on a Friday night at 2 in the morning that are going into labor. That's not what they're using it for.
So, funny story, but an acquaintance of mine, when we were talking, Rebecca was talking with him about, you know, mentioned that the epidural was fentanyl. And he had some runs with drugs. And he was like, what did it feel like? How was it? She was like, what do you mean? I was giving birth. I wasn't trying to get high off of it. What do you mean? How was it? Like, shut up. What a stupid question. Anyway, I always thought it was cheaper. I thought it was, you know, one of those things that you can cut with other drugs, save some money. But yeah, now it's like people are just doing straight fentanyl and
it's wild.
It's so cheap that you can just get it. Yeah, I've heard it's like $2 a pill, and then you crush it up and smoke it, and there you're good for the day.
Question for you guys: the homeless population, right, had just significant increases. I mean, James, I don't know if you so here maybe not. It feels, but I can tell you, like, if you've been to Bend, have you been to Bend recently?
Yeah,
not recently.
It's not like it would blow your mind.
Really,
it doesn't make a lot of sense. But
so I think
happening.
It's hard to say in Portland proper whether it was an increase in the number or they just were much more visible. Because I remember it was during the pandemic when they stopped enforcing any kind any kind of laws. And so I remember Chinatown is where a lot of them hang out, and they would, you know, pre-pandemic, they would clear everybody out on Friday and Saturday night because that's where all the clubs are. And so they'd clear out all the homeless on Friday, and then you would have your clubbing Friday and Saturday, and then they'd all come back and pick up their stuff. And then for 2 years of pandemic, there was no enforcement. There was no cleaning everybody up. And so they just kind of like stayed.
I do think there has been an increase in the homeless population in Portland. And I say that because you talk to a lot of people who will go out and like and do interviews and have conversations with these folks. And one of the things that comes up is, well, where are you from? And you will get a ton of Boise or Chicago or Miami or Dallas or all these different.
Interesting.
And the city of Portland and the state of Oregon has this, you know, welcome sign. And just like Greg Abbott in Texas is sending people who illegally cross the border over, you know, to sanctuary cities, to New York, Chicago, to say, okay, you guys are saying you're comfortable with this here. Like, you can see what a strain on your resource it is. And we can have a discussion about whether that's a good or bad policy, but it does, it's effective. And there's that now you'll start to see mayors of some of these bigger cities saying, we don't have the ability to take on more individuals who have illegally crossed the southern border. We are kind of in the same boat in Oregon, where there's a lot of individuals who have, they said, yeah, mayor of Salt Lake City, mayor of Chicago, they bought us bus tickets. They bought us, you know, they sent us out here, whatever. And then now, because we are the place that doesn't really enforce laws, we don't have vagrancy laws. We don't enforce them. We allow open air camping, especially after the Boise and the Grants Pass decisions. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of opportunities. Two Supreme Court decisions that had said if
Circuit Court, Ninth Circuit Court, not Supreme Court.
Not Supreme Court yet, Ninth right. Circuit Court.
Well, because it matters that it's because it's this region, well, it's not national law.
Well, and I think it is about to go to the Supreme Court and they're about to get overturned. But they said you cannot clear people out of from open air camping or anything like that if you don't have a place for them to go. So if you don't have, you know, the tiny house villages or, you know, a sanctuary like Wapato was going to be this for a while. If you don't have a place for homeless people to go, you can't say you have to, you know, pick up stakes and you can't be, you know, camping under this overpass or anything like that. And I think that has led to a lot more prevalence of, and certainly I think it's a lot more common. There's a lot more people who are kind of doing it out in the open and making a lifestyle mm-hmm. out of it. You're not forced to relocate as often. But I do think the numbers have increased in Portland just because we've got so many folks from other places.
You're the second person to tell me that it's, you're also second and third person to have this conversation, but this from this area that's told me that there's people coming from out of state, which is interesting to me. Like his opinion was that because drugs are legal, people are coming across the country for drugs. Part of me wonders, that's wild, because like I've never traveled anywhere out of state just for drugs, but I mean, maybe someone becomes that desperate in a state that I don't know. But the homeless thing.
So if you listen to people who work in Multnomah County, especially on the far left, who run the region here, they will deny that up and down. They will say, nope, they're all homegrown. Nobody's coming here for drugs. And I haven't seen any studies of, I don't know, maybe you have, but, it's sort of like just this talking point where people on the right are like, people are coming here. You know, it's supply and demand. When you tell people we're not enforcing laws and you can come here and, you know, do drugs in the street without any repercussions, that people will be drawn here. And then you have people on the left who are saying, no, that's not true. It's a housing crisis. We need to, you know, more government intervention to get housing prices down, which is why we have people who can't afford homes and then they turn to drugs. So the left sees it as a housing crisis that manifests itself as a drug problem. And I mean, I personally think that's completely backwards, but then the narrative from the right is people are coming here for the drugs, whether they come voluntarily or they come because they got sent. I don't know, but
I think some people, I don't,
well,
think
I'm sure there's a
person is from Duluth or whatever.
Well, true.
Yeah. You're right. Traveling can be expensive. Like if you're just a drug addict and
you know
some Alabama city, I mean, get across the states for, I guess you can hitchhike or stuff, but I do wonder if
Greyhound tickets aren't that expensive.
Yeah, that's true. And desperation, man.
Yeah.
It is an interesting thing. Like the drugs are definitely a part of the handling adversity, right? I mean, the way we handle adversity, there's plenty of evidence that shows when people go through hard times, they turn to drugs or alcohol to ease the pain. And going through that pandemic, I mean, I don't know how many people lost their homes, but I do know that repo, like the repo industry, is there's they have a shortage of people and shortage of trucks because there's all these repos going on for people who did not pay for their vehicles through the pandemic. And so like there's this economic shift that happened. And so I wonder how much during the pandemic people either lost their homes, couldn't pay for stuff, and then turned to, you know, well, I might as well start drinking. And then that turned into this. And then next thing you know, 2 years later, it's not hard to go from a normal life, so to speak, to sitting on the corner smoking crack. And like,
One other comment on this is that in the metro area, and I can't speak for Bend or other places, there are nearly infinite resources for people about to lose their house. Like there's rental assistance, there's all sorts of stuff, tenants' rights. I would be very surprised if there are a significant number of people losing their homes due to unaffordability.
Okay.
And that's just my anecdote, 2 cents, but like there's so much available.
Do people know? So one,
I mean, that might be a problem. Yeah, I mean, maybe
that was one of the things why changing patterns started was because there were all these resources, but they were siloed and people didn't know about them. And so you get out, and if you don't know how to look for them or know who to ask, and especially if you don't trust your PO, it's easy to give up, right? And so I wonder how many people know about those resources as well.
I think a lot of them came into existence during the pandemic. There was a lot of rental assistance type stuff. So hard to say what happened before then, but I work with a lot of landlords and property managers in my business. And that was a thing that they were continuously dealing with, was people who wouldn't pay, and then they would have to go jump through all these hoops to get rental assistance from the state. And then they would finally get paid, and then they would stop paying again. And like it was a huge hassle for the property managers to have to deal with all the paperwork involved to get their rent payments. But they evicted very few people during that time because they always managed to get what they needed to get.
Is there a solution to this homeless issue?
Not an easy one.
No.
I would hazard.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody's got a quick fix. I mean, I think that the left is right in that housing is very unaffordable. And I mean, anything is unaffordable. Like inflation prices are up 10-15% from where they were 3 years ago. Stuff is very expensive these days. There's no two ways.
The issue that I have with the left is that they try to make the two the same.
Just have one issue.
They try to say that the homelessness and drugs and housing affordability are all the same problem that can all be fixed by more money going to the government. And, I disagree. I agree that those are three problems. I don't think that they're all have the same solution. And it certainly is not higher taxes.
What if the left and here's a crazy idea. What if the left and the right came together and agreed and worked together towards the solution?
Nah, never. Would never happen.
Is that wild? Was that too crazy?
If there's enough people who listen to this podcast. Although we did have, there was one person who reached out and he just said, you know, I'm a Democrat and I was really looking for some moderate centrist thought. And then he wrote a second email and was just like, this is the, you guys are these MAGA. And I was just like, buddy, if you think we're too extreme to have, I'm sorry, man, I don't really, I don't know about that. I think we do a decently good job of reaching across the aisle and having people with differing political opinions.
We are Pottersons, you know, we are Republicans. It's in the title.
I think honestly, probably not easiest solution or even an easy solution, but I think the easiest solution is to kind of do what you said, is for any individual citizen to become a little bit more involved. I think on the left, your vision of becoming more involved is having more government programs, is paying higher taxes so that there can be more this level of county, this, and this level of state, this, and this level of city, this, and this level of metro, this. I think on the right, it's traditionally been, I volunteer at my church. I have this organization that I, you know, civically involved, you know, the Boy Scouts or, you know, whatever it is that you do with your time. There are a number of different ways that people feel that they themselves are involved and are part of the solution. But I think if all you do is put your feet up every night and yell at the TV for talking about the problems that you then try to vote for somebody to go fix and you yourself don't do anything about it, I think you're going to have a very long life of sitting there yelling at the TV because I don't think any of those problems are going to get solved.
Yeah. Like, let's not pretend that the government cares. You know what I mean? There's a big piece of and we'll just say like federal, but there's a big piece of whether you're right or left. I mean, Nancy Pelosi doesn't care about the left as much as, you know, whoever else. It's hard. I haven't met a politician ever, but I haven't met one either that knows my name, you know? Mm. And I do like the idea of us as a community get our hands dirty and take responsibility for the problems that we don't like, right?
Yeah.
I don't like the fact that Oregon has one of the low, or Deschutes County has one of the lowest crime rates out of all the counties, yet is the third highest recidivism rate.
Hmm.
And we have a ton of money, which means resources available. What's going on here? So that's why we're getting involved. And no, yeah, I don't think, you know, there's a place for everyone for helping in the community, right? Like, don't send, I don't know. I can't think of an example, but like,
you're right.
Yeah. Go find your spot. And you even said it, you know, go volunteer at your church in whatever the church is doing. Yeah. And I'd almost say vote small. Where vote mm-hmm. local, yeah. like people, that's yeah. where, like, it's crazy how much popularity the presidential thing gets, and yet our senators and congresspeople are like lifelong politicians that are making all these laws, and we're concerned whether you know, we're gonna have weekend of Bidens or, you know, Trump again yelling at the camera, like, yeah. we got this orange or this dead dude, what are we, you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
like, but what are our local politicians doing with the things that are actually affecting our daily lives?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as much as I'd love to keep this going, guys, we are well over time. And so one of the things we like to do at the end of our podcast is ask our guests who their favorite Republican is. I don't know if you remember who you gave last time.
Did I? I had to go back and check.
You had to go check.
Teddy. But you know what? I did some research. I'm going to pick our boy Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln,
which
yep.
sometimes throws Solid. People off that they don't like, oh, yeah, for what he did, it's very easy to think like, what was he a Republican? And yes, he was.
Sure was.
One
he
of the first.
He made some changes and got popped for it. So respect to the big L.
Yeah. Got it. Appreciate it. Well, Frank, again, thanks so much for coming on the show, and good luck with all the stuff you're doing over in Bend and in Austin. And listeners, we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Rational Republican Podcast. Your hosts are James Ball and Nick Prilosky. The show today is brought to you by ProLift Garage Doors of Portland, serving the greater Portland metro area for all your garage door installation and repair needs. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us at james@jamesaball.com or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. You can find our episodes at jamesaball.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts.